May it please the court, I represent the three appellants in this case, Carlos Araneta, Lisa Berenguer, and Hugo Bonilla. The real parties in interest in this case are all Philippines businessmen. Carlos Araneta, they call him a tycoon in their brief, which is not inapt. ATR is an acronym for Ramon Arnaiz, Manuel Tordesillas, and somebody Rojas, who had nothing to do with this case. This case arises out of a business deal that was struck in the Philippines in 1999. And the gist of the deal was that ATR would put up about $3.9 million. They would acquire what was called a pre-need company in the Philippines. And then they would create this essentially joint venture, a holding company where all the rights arising from the $3.9 million would be put into the holding company. And the Araneta family would contribute businesses it owned and operated, which the parties at the time valued at roughly $36 million. And there were principally two sets of businesses. There were the Philippines businesses, which were all under the name LBC Development, and there were some USA businesses under LBC Holdings USA. The agreements, I think, were signed in July 1999, and they contemplated that all of this would be done, set up and operating within 3 months. What the record shows and what the court found was that in 2003 there was a serious falling out between Mr. Araneta and Mr. Arnaiz, who had been longtime childhood friends. That led to several lawsuits in the Philippines, and it led to this lawsuit. The court below, the vice chancellor, found here that sometime in the second half of 2003, Mr. Araneta removed from LBC Global, which was a Delaware company set up initially with the intent on both sides to be the holding company. Vice Chancellor found that sometime in 2003, Araneta removed those assets. It made an alternative finding that if the assets had never been put in the first place and had never been removed, then Araneta had breached his fiduciary duties to the plaintiffs by misstatements to the contrary. A reading of the opinion shows that the court plainly disliked Mr. Araneta and plainly found him to be untruthful and ruled against him in every way it possibly could. The court awarded a basic damages award. Interestingly, and this will be the subject of one of our key points of appeal, it awarded damages as of 1999, not 2003, when the breach was found by the court. It awarded a somewhat extraordinary prejudgment interest rate of 25%. That brought the judgment to $24 million. It awarded past attorney's fees. It awarded future attorney's fees, their costs of collection. And it even went on to opine that if there's a fight in the future between Araneta on one side and Bonilla and Berenguer on the other, Araneta loses that too, to the extent that dicta has any impact. But it's fair to say the court ruled against us across the board in every conceivable way it could, and the opinion reflects that. There's a lot in that opinion with which we disagree, but on appeal, we've raised 3 points, but there's two that are critical, and those are the two I'm going to talk about today, because there were two basic errors by the court, and each of those errors, I submit, is apparent on the face of the opinion. The first error is the court's basic factual findings that assets were at some point put into LBC Global and at some point taken out are simply unsupported by the record as a whole and actually somewhat nonsensical when you look at the record. And in any event, as made clear by this court's recent decision in the Seaford Golf and Country Club case, the failure of the vice chancellor even to address this contrary evidence, no discussion of it at all in his opinion, shows that his conclusions were not the product of an orderly and logical deductive process. That's point one, which I'll address in just a moment. The second major issue, and we submit plain legal error, is the remedy. In simple terms, if this court agreed with or simply affirmed every single factual finding of the court below, it would not lead to the remedy ordered by the court or anything like that remedy. Because what the court did was award damages starting 4 years before the breach found by the court and supposedly to remedy an injury which had nothing to do with the findings of the court. Let me turn to the first point. The two basic fact issues in this case were, did the parties in fact go through with what unquestionably was their original intent to use this Delaware holding company, LBC Global, and did they in fact put these assets into it? And the second fact issue was, if that happened, were they ever actually taken out? Now, every member of this court has litigation experience, and you know, these are not complex fact issues. Transferring significant assets are things that require various legal steps, depending on where you are. But these simple questions of were assets ever put in and were they ever taken out should not have been all that hard to resolve.
Well, your primary legal position, or factual position, I should say, in connection with the first claim of error is that the assets were not put into LBC Global and the court erred at finding otherwise.
That's right? Exactly right, Your Honor.
And, of course, if that's correct, then the issue of whether the assets were put back, that is, taken out again, is moot, is that right?
That's correct. And, in fact, on what until late in the case was their only claim, which was a derivative claim, there would be no jurisdiction in this court over any claims.
If, on the other hand, the assets, it were found that the assets were put into LBC Global, is it your client's contention that they were later removed or not removed or what? I mean, I don't know where the "and removed" it dangles out there, and I'm not sure it matters.
Well, it matters in this respect, Your Honor. My client's position, and it's been our position from day one in this case, from the initial status conference, it is that whatever the papers say, the parties didn't do this deal. They decided not to put the assets in. Now, the significance of the lack of any evidence of this second transfer that actually is the basis for the liability is it just reinforces that these assets were never put in the first place.
Your factual position was we never put the assets in, but if we did, we never removed them?
No. It was we never put them in, period, Your Honor. But what the court found was they had been put in, and then the court found, because it was the basis for liability, they had been removed. And essentially there's no evidence of any of those steps, either putting them in the first time or taking them out, all of which leads ultimately to the conclusion they weren't put in, that that's the only sensible conclusion one can draw from this record.
Okay, so the removal really drops out of this picture for analytical purposes. That is, the real issue, as you frame it, is whether the assets were ever put in.
Yes, although I do think it is relevant. Where there's no evidence of the removal, that simply reinforces the point that there wasn't evidence to begin with that they were put in. Now, I think it is important to note this was our position from the outset, from the first status conference. And you know, it is an unusual position for a litigant to come in and say, yes, I signed these statements saying this had happened, and I'm saying it didn't. This is what the lower court, you know, somewhat sarcastically, but not inaccurately, characterized as "believe me now, I was lying then" defense.
Well, let's just look at it hypothetically. We knew the other side, Mr. Arnaz's side, put in there $3.9 million. Or let's assume hypothetically
Yes. They
did. And let's assume that your client, just we'll call it a building, agreed to put in a building. Your client signs a piece of paper that says, I put the building into the corporation. However, a deed was never prepared. A deed was never recorded. But yet, we've got a statement that says, I put the building into the corporation. using that as an analogy, how does your argument then follow? That the corporation or the shareholders could have forced the building to be put in, gotten the deed executed, or your position seems to be, I know I agreed to put the building in, I know I signed a letter that said I put the building in, but it never happened, and that's just too bad. I've changed my mind.
Let me start with one preliminary point. If one reads the undertaking agreement, there was an agreement to put them in, but there was a specified remedy if it didn't happen. The agreement especially contemplated it might not happen. And essentially what the agreement said was they can back out and they can get the $4 million. Here, in that hypothetical, clearly the statements by Mr. Arenetta are admissions. Clearly the court could look to those as evidence that the assets were put in. But if, in fact, at the end of the day, nothing was done to actually legally transfer those assets, then that is factually what the court might find. Now, it doesn't mean Mr. Arenetta gets a free pass on his statements. If there is liability, and the court alternatively found those misstatements were a breach of fiduciary duty, he's liable for the consequences of that. But in terms of this case, where their whole case factually rested on you took the assets out, and you can't take them out if they were never put in, what flows from that is the court has to find that there is some substantial evidence that, in fact, notwithstanding these statements, the steps legally necessary to transfer assets occurred. And there is zero evidence of that here.
And what did the chancellor, the vice chancellor, say when you said you've got the right idea, the wrong remedy? Their remedies under the agreement.
Well, if you read the court's opinion, the court never really addressed our argument as to why the court must find that the assets were never put in the first place. When it became clear that that was our position and deep in the case, that's when ACR pleaded this alternative theory. And we lost on that. And we haven't appealed that. If, in fact, this court reverses the basic findings, then what has to happen is a remand for a remedy for a wrong found by the court, breach of fiduciary duty by misstatements, which we haven't appealed. We're stuck with that. And that's really what ought to happen here.
Well, that leads to the another question following up on Justice Holland regarding your remedy argument. If this court were to find that, contrary to what the Vice Chancellor found, that the assets were never put into LBC, then that eliminates, does it not, the damages remedy argument? That is to say, the breach would have taken place in 1999, and so there is no argument that the remedy antedates the breach by 4 years, which would be the case if we were to affirm the essential fact.
No, that is not correct, Your Honor, and let me explain why. If the failure to put in the assets to LBC Global was a violation of some obligation, it was a violation of the Philippines contract. It wasn't a violation of fiduciary duties. LBC Global didn't exist. The agreement didn't say we're going to use a Delaware holding company. The agreement said we're going to set up a holding company. And everybody agrees it could have been Delaware, it could have been non-U.S. There may be. I don't think there is, frankly, under the agreements. But if my clients had an obligation under the agreements to put assets in and did not, then their remedy is a suit in the Philippines under these agreements that say they're covered by Philippines law.
Right, that may be true, but the LBC entity was formed, and your client was a fiduciary, that is the 90% owner of that entity, and under the court's alternative finding, even though assets were not injected into LBC Global, your client caused the entity, and indeed, he also made false statements that they were put in. And the consequence of that is that Mr. Arenetta and his interests invested over $3 million, and that money was kept in the corporation and used by your clients for no compensation. So doesn't that remedy fit the wrong if the wrong is the alternative wrong that the Chancellor found?
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, the court made no finding that the $4 million they put in, the rights to that were actually transferred to LBC Global. I mean, what happened?
So you're contesting that the plaintiffs, they're saying they didn't put in their money?
No. They put in their money, but they put in their money before there was an LBC Global. And
so
what they did was, they had a Philippines holding corporation called PMHI, I think it was. They advanced money to PMHI. PMHI bought this pre-need company, and the rights to that money, or the rights to the stock, were, at the end of the day, to be put into the holding company. But let me go back. Even if that had happened in 1999, the alternative breach of fiduciary duty found by the lower court was that in 2001, Araneta misled these people and said, yes, I put the assets in, and I have not. What the court did not find is what injury, if any, flowed from that. What they argued flowed from that. They said this was important to us in doing this separate Philtred deal. And the Philtred deal was a very complicated and odd sort of thing, but essentially they said, We put even more money into Philtred, and we never would have done it had we known this. If, in fact, they were injured by the misstatements, it's an entirely different category of injury. The lower court made no findings as to what the injury would be on its alternative findings. I can tell the court I am confident the injury would be a whole lot less than $24 million. I don't think they even claimed it was anything approaching that. They essentially said, look, in reliance on these statements, we made investments. And we made public disclosures, and we now face the risk.
Well, the damages were the $3-plus million plus compounded interest, correct?
No, because they retained the rights to that. They have rights under the undertaking agreement, and that's exactly what the Philippines court has ruled. The undertaking agreement gave them a number of rights, one of which was at any point they could put their rights under the agreement to Araneta, and he's got to pay them. And that's what the Philippines court has said they've got to do. But for misstatement, if there is a separate injury from misstatements in 2001, which were made, they say the injury is we relied on those statements to make do a business deal. Well, the court made no finding of what the injury would be, but there's no logical reason it would tie to 1999. It would be what was the injury as of 2001 based on that. I'm already into my rebuttal time.
You have a minute and 15 seconds of your total time left.
Let me quickly move to remedy. Essentially the court awarded damages as of 1999, 4 years before the breach. It is settled Delaware law, which they don't dispute, that damages are intended to compensate for the injury resulting from the wrong found by the court. The court's opinion on its face did something entirely different. He justified a direct remedy by saying this was a de facto liquidation. He made no attempt to determine what the value would be to them in a de facto liquidation. He made no attempt to determine the injury to the company as a result of the removal. He went back to 1999 and awarded them damages for entrusting their capital to Araneta, which was never even a legal claim by them in this case, and there was never any claim Araneta did anything wrong before 2003. I see I've already used up my time. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but if not, I will sit down. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Just one moment if I might pull my papers up. May it please the Court, Stephen Margolin on behalf of the Pelley ATR companies. With me at counsel table today from my office is Lauren McGuire. With the Court's indulgence, I'd like to just take a couple moments to try to set a stage in light of some of the comments here this morning from Mr. Arnetta's counsel, because it was a bit more broad-ranging, frankly, than the appellate brief in this Court, and dug up some old issues that we had thought were long ago put to bed in the Chancery Court. So I'd like to back up and really address what the papers below, and we certainly encourage the Court to look at them, have maintained since the day one of this case, and all of the pretrial briefing and all of the post-trial briefing focused on this point. And that is, this case really came down to Mr. Arnetta's credibility, period. And the reason I say that is, notwithstanding the argument you heard this morning, in fact, at the initial office conference in this case, on July 7th, 2004, Mr. Arnetta's counsel told the Court, and I'm quoting now, the reason there were no assets in LBC Global, and this is the quote, is ATR didn't put in the assets they were supposed to. They sold them. Now, this is cited in our post-trial briefing at page 26, but the point of this is there was no suggestion that the assets didn't go in for some other reason. None of the two or three or four iterations of Mr. Arnetta's story that changed over time, a story that changed even on the day of trial. The initial position taken with the Court was, yeah, there are some documents that say the assets went in, but they're all fake because the deal never happened because ATR didn't do their part. That story has changed so many times. Mr. Arnetta needed a story to explain away the contemporaneous record. And this is another point demonstrated below. And that is that all of the documents, and they're cited at pages 15 through 20, I believe, of our briefing. There are about 100 sites, I believe, in the lower court's opinion to this record. Every single contemporaneous document, without exception, confirms the company's ownership of these assets. These are documents prepared by Mr. Arnetta himself, by his CFO, niece, and co-director, Ms. Beringer, who's also, of course, a defendant in this case, by their outside U.S. accountant who submitted those documents, including tax returns, to both the federal government and the state of Delaware, as the Vice Chancellor noted, under penalties of perjury.
So your argument, as I understand it, going back to my analogy to a deed, is that if you execute a great many documents to say I've transferred the office building, and then you represent that many, many times in all these documents that you have described, the fact that you never executed the deed and record it isn't really significant because you've represented that you did it and you've carried on your business as if you've already done it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that it's of no significance under the hypothetical that Your Honor might offer, because deeds carry with them certain public filing requirements and other issues that are simply not present here. The way I would address the Court's question is this. The argument asserted eventually below was, gee, there's not a stock certificate that says this was transferred. And let me be clear, that's the sum and substance of the argument. Mr. Arnetta was faced with a stack of emails saying, I'm transferring the certificates. They're cited in our brief from December 2000. He actually says, I am causing the certificates from all the subsidiaries to be transferred to Delaware. Let's do this. That's December 2000. They have never, ever addressed that email. Not once. Not once below, not once at trial, not once in their briefing here or their argument today. And the reason they don't is because, to draw my own analogy, if I might, it's like the weather forecast. It's the old deductive reasoning that we all learned. If the weather forecast tells you when you go to bed one night, it's going to snow tonight, and you wake up in the morning and there's snow on the ground, it doesn't matter if you saw it snow overnight. It happened. We have Mr. Arnetta saying, I'm transferring the certificates, and then 3 weeks later, he signs the January 2001 letter that says, I have transferred every one of these companies.
Well, maybe you misunderstood my analogy. The purpose of the recording statute is to put third parties on notice. But there's a lot of law that says between the two people that are involved, the fact that there hasn't been a recording doesn't necessarily have adverse consequences between those two parties.
Then I did misunderstand, Your Honor. I apologize. That is exactly the point we are making here, is that Mr. Arnetta and his co-directors and his outside accountants told everyone, not just as between us, but the U.S. and Delaware governments as well, that this happened. And that's where I tried to start today, which is, faced with that, Mr. Arnetta had to come up with something, right? He had to say, while I'm stuck, it certainly looks like all these went. And on a side note, I should mention that through the entire trial, Mr. Arnetta denied, really, that those documents existed or they said anything or that they said they transferred. The first time the appellants now have ever conceded that those documents even suggest maybe there was ownership was in this court. At trial, Mr. Arnetta was forced to concede that there wasn't a single document anywhere in the record, including those he had cited to the Chancery Court in briefing and in discovery to us, that actually supported this case. So he needed some story for, okay, there's this huge contemporaneous record that says, yeah, the Delaware company owns them. How do I get around that? And in a bold move, Mr. Arnetta is a trained lawyer. He has a law firm in the Philippines that was actively involved in this case, and he's got excellent Delaware counsel. And they put their heads together, apparently, and they came up with what the court accurately called the believe me now, I was lying then defense. Mr. Arnetta gave variations on don't believe the contemporaneous record because.
So going back to understanding everyone's goal in this case, your response to the argument that your remedy is the agreement because the assets were never put in is no, that's we're not asking for a remedy under the agreement. We're asking for a remedy for breach of fiduciary duty because we think the record supports the Vice Chancellor's conclusion that the assets were put in, and therefore, to the extent the assets were redeployed, these three directors are responsible.
Without question, Your Honor, I frankly could not have said that better. And to that point, again, it's addressed in our briefing, but for reference on the record today, I'd refer the court to the B appendix submitted with our brief at pages 92 and 93. And what the court will see there are two balance sheets prepared by Mr. Arnetta, one dated as of May 31, 2003, and one dated as December 31, 2003. Those were discussed at trial, and it's in the transcript. And Mr. Arnetta acknowledged that he prepared them. He prepared the May 1 to show what the status of the company was at that time, and he prepared the December 1 while the 220 action was pending to show the status in December. The difference between those two balance sheets, and it's undisputed, is it shows the removal of subsidiaries. The suggestion this morning that there's no evidence the subsidiaries removed is unfortunately just wrong, flat wrong. But more importantly, Mr. Arnetta testified at trial that in his view, he had offset those assets. He had taken them out of the company's asset pool and offset them by reducing a book entry liability to his family's interest. So there's all the evidence you need that they came out. Now, our brief addresses this issue that there weren't stock ledgers, and I briefly touched on it, but just to close that loop, Mr. Arnetta also conceded at trial that he treats his companies as what I will characterize as the sort of traditional private sandbox view of private companies. They have a very different way of doing things in the Philippines that became clear in this case. But Mr. Arnetta conceded that the stock ledgers for his companies sometimes don't exist at all. Sometimes he does no transfer documents. And in fact, when I showed him a transfer document that did come in his file, and it was one showing that he took out valuable banking assets from one of the subsidiaries in the Philippines, Ms. Beringer was involved, just took it out, gave it to himself, and entered a book entry, once again, on the accounting books to the extent they exist, saying, well, I now own these assets and there's some theoretical paper exchange. Mr. Arnetta said, well, that transfer never happened. And I said, well, here's a document that says a transfer happened. You're saying it didn't. He said, that's right. And then I showed him the ledger for this company, LBC Global, and it's in the appendix and it's cited in our brief. It is undisputed in this case that Mr. Arnetta was the 90% shareholder of LBC Global. We have his stock certificate. It's undisputed. And Mr. Arnetta then transferred his interest to another of his companies called Lucky Business Corporation on January 9, 2001. This is undisputed. And it's written on the stock certificate, I made this transfer. Neither of those transfers appear in LBC Global's ledger. So there's no record of that transfer other than one little handwritten note by Mr. Arnetta. It's not on the ledger. And he concedes the transfer happened. He is on both sides of any issue. If it's a transfer he likes, it happened. If it's a transfer he didn't like, it didn't. And his records are a mess.
Mr. McGowan, I'd like to ask you about the second issue on appeal, which is the remedy.
Yes, sir.
If this court affirms the factual finding of the court that the assets were put into LBC Global and then later taken out, we're confronted with the argument that the remedy antedates the breach by 4 years. How does one justify that on a fiduciary duty basis?
Your Honor, part of the disconnect, I believe, on this issue between the parties is that the case law that is cited by the appellants and the arguments they assert are in the non-disloyalty context. They cite some contract cases for the theory that, gee, if there's a breach of contract, you look at the date of the breach, and I don't think that could be disputed on any grounds. But the remedy that was affected here, and it was expressly requested and described in the papers below, and the court went to pretty significant pains to cite and quote the cases, was the Thorpe v. Serco disloyalty line of cases. And those cases state very clearly the mandate from this court, which is that an award for disloyalty is not narrow. Rather, it is a public policy of Delaware that the award must not only address a damage to plaintiff, which would sort of be the traditional contract model that my opponent has offered today, but, and I'm quoting, of course, now from Thorpe v. Serco, extinguish all possibility of profit flowing to the wrongdoer. And, of course, there are any number of cases that follow those, the Bomarco cases and others. The point here is that the appellants look at the remedy on their assumption that this should be a contract dispute. But it isn't. It's not what the vice chancellor said, and it's not what happened.
All right,
this was a remedy that needs to capture Mr. Araneta's benefit.
Okay, that I understand the theory now. Now apply the theory to the facts here.
Certainly. It is undisputed that Mr. Araneta obtained my client's funds in connection with this investment in Delaware Company in 1999. And it's undisputed that he has had the use of that money since that time. It is undisputed that Mr. Araneta's stated cost for equity capital, private equity capital, and that's what this was, that's also undisputed, it was a private equity investment by my clients, was 25%. It is further undisputed, testified to at trial by Mr. Araneta and by his American, the gentleman who ran his American operations, Mr. Bonilla, another appellant here, that the reason Mr. Araneta's carrying cost is such, and the reason he's willing to pay that is because he achieves that benefit from it. His cost of capital, his cost of debt capital, which should be lower, is 18%.
Well, is there any evidence that he actually used your client's money, even when you look at the difference in the balance sheets that you cited in the appendix? It shows, as I understand it, after the money was taken out, according to your theory, that there was the 3.9 in as an asset. So one way to look at the record is that the money never went anywhere, was never used for anything.
No, Your Honor, and it's a confusing methodology that the Philippine accountants here, the Philippine financiers used, and again, it's undisputed, but...
All right, well, just tell the court what he did with your client's money, and then we can figure out where it is in the record.
Originally, there was a related but separate deal that essentially Mr. Araneta elected to take the $4 million that my clients invested as equity capital in the Delaware company and take that and then immediately invest it in a collateral deal.
So somewhere, if we looked in the record and sorted this out, we would find that happened in 1999.
Yes, that absolutely happened in 1999, and that, too, was undisputed, Your Honor. It was the subject of some testimony below because the vice chancellor wanted to make sure that he understood the nature, the relationship of these transactions, and it is, in fact, detailed in the opinion below. This is the PMHI investment.
Okay.
In any event, it is undisputed that Mr. Araneta got the benefit of our money in 1999 and used it immediately. It's also undisputed that the reason Mr. Araneta was seeking private equity and using a Delaware company was in anticipation of an IPO. He is in a growth industry. It's difficult to explain in the few minutes I have left, but essentially, Mr. Araneta's business has been analogized by someone in the case to a combination of FedEx and what used to be Western Union with wire transfers. Now they do it with ATMs. One of the single greatest exports of the Philippine nation is its workers. They actually have a government office called the OFW, Office of Foreign Workers. It is roughly, it's in the low single digits or high double digits of their entire GNP. They ship out workers. and they rely on those workers to send funds and send packages back to the Philippines, literally to keep the country afloat. That's Mr. Arenado's business. He realized, and his sons, I think the testimony is, really realized, that with the global economy, as it was becoming a global economy in the late 90s, this was an opportunity for him to leverage his foreign workers and offices all over the world and their use of LBC, which is the number one name brand, apparently, according to Ms. Berenger, in this industry. So all of the growth of those subsidiaries over that time was part of what my clients were supposed to be sharing it. That's why they got in.
And as I understand it, it was not possible to quantify what that growth was. That is, the actual benefit that Mr. Arenado received, and therefore what the court did is a proxy for quantifying the benefit was basically to compound interest at the rate of 25% on the initial investment from 1999 through the date of judgment. Is that correct?
I think that's mostly correct, Your Honor, if I can just restate, at least as I understand the record. Because it was undisputed that Mr. Araneta's expected benefit from this was at least 25%, because that's what he agreed the carrying cost would be, and I think the only logical inference is he expected at least that rate of return, given where the market was heading with his industry. It is correct that the Vice Chancellor used that number as a proxy for determining the benefit that flowed to Mr. Arenado. And although it's not accurately quoted in the appellant's brief, twice the opinion below actually says, I'm entering this award not only to try to make ATR whole, but to ensure that Mr. Arenado doesn't benefit, words to that effect. And yes, because Mr. Arenado's records were so convoluted, and I'm glad to try and answer questions on that if the court has questions, but there was no way to accurately quantify. And in fact,
I understand your argument, it's a little bit like in Weinberger, which was not an appraisal case, but there was a problem and the court looked at the breach of fiduciary duty and then looked at the appraisal statute to craft a remedy. Here, according to your argument, as I understand it, the Court of Chancery has broad equitable powers. This is a breach of loyalty case, and to the extent the court was looking in other places to craft its remedy, it was entitled to do that, and this was a logical place to look.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is my client's position. We believe that under the mandate of this case to remedy disloyalty, in fact, the court was required to find something that would be a logical proxy to try to assess Mr. Arenado's value. And looking to the undisputed facts and the undisputed timeline, we believe is appropriate. And on that point, I should note, to be very clear, fairly read, the appellants do not challenge the 25%. They're not happy about it because it's a large number. But it's not challenged on this appeal, and it can't be because it's undisputed. They also don't challenge the compounding. And in their reply brief, they do acknowledge, ultimately, the compounding was something that was requested below in accordance with the trend and the realistic view of the Chancery Court of Investment. They didn't challenge that either. So the only issue that is actually before the court today on the appeal was, can you go back to 99? But since it's undisputed that that is the date on which Mr. Arenado accrued the benefit, we believe that under the Thorpe and Bomarco view of disloyalty, it was required for the Chancery Court to go to that date. Otherwise, it would leave Mr. Arenado with some of the increased benefit of the subsidiary's value over that time and free use of my client's money, which would be directly contrary to the policy stated in Thorpe.
Well, let me, in the short amount of time you have, ask you to respond to Mr. Allen's observation. He said there was a breach of fiduciary duty by misstatements that isn't challenged on appeal, and that there should be a remand to craft a remedy related to that undisputed breach. And then Mr. Allen says, and that would be a lot less than $24 million. What's your reaction?
Two reactions quickly, Your Honor. One is the number here, the $24 million number, is simply a mathematical function. It's one that Mr. Allen and I worked out given the undisputed rates and the timing. So I don't think that the relative size of the number has any bearing. But on the Malone point specifically, Malone itself is a disloyalty-based liability finding, and the court did make that finding. And thus, following Malone, I think, to its logical end, the misrepresentations, which were made as a fiduciary, as Justice Jacobs correctly pointed out, I believe would be within this court's power were it to find that the remedy should have been a Malone claim rather than the Thorpe claim. I think it's logical to get to the same place. The question is still, there has been a disloyalty finding. What do we do to make sure Mr. Aaron didn't benefit from it? And I believe you wind up in the same place. I don't believe it would be necessary for remand because the vice chancellor said, I find that this would be a Malone claim if for some reason the assets didn't go in. I find they did, but even if I didn't, he's liable, and the appellants, as they correctly said this morning, don't challenge that finding. So I think were the situation to wind up there, a similar remedy would be appropriate.
Thank you very much.
I only have a few seconds left unless the court has a question. I would just
Over your time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're going the other way on the clock.
I see that, Your Honor. I wrapped around the odometer. I apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you for the court's time.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, you had 4 seconds left. You could rise where you are, and if you'd like to say something in 2 or 3 sentences, that would be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. The one point I want to address, particularly a question from Justice Jacobs, is the lower court did not adopt its remedy because it found an inability to quantify damages as of 2003. That's the problem. Nothing in the opinion suggests that. The court made no attempt to say, fine, these assets were removed, what are they worth, what's the damages? And that's the real problem. And when he went to 1999, I mean, I understand why they want to defend this remedy based on cost of equity. But if that is what you're curing, then you are, in fact, duplicating exactly what was done in Philippines. Because they had a contractual right to be bought out with an interest rate of 20 to 25%. That's the remedy they've been given in the Philippines. The issue before this court, where the vice chancellor should have been, what additional damage or different damage was suffered as a result of the removal of assets. And there's no analysis of that.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your briefing and your oral arguments in this matter. We'll take it under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.